Before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. If you are, you know, grinding for the Series 7 right now, they've got this full course with adaptive study quizzes and smart flashcards.
Yeah, and the practice exams are great.
Oh, yeah, unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. It's awesome. So definitely check it out at CertFuel.com.
For sure.
Okay, let's unpack this, because today's mission is all about mastering the equity instruments that live outside of normal stock. We're talking rights, warrants, and international investing via ADRs.
Right, the equity extensions.
Exactly. And look, if you're listening to this, I know your study style because it's mine too.
Yeah.
My ADHD means if you give me a dry textbook lecture, I am gone. I am checked out.
You just glaze over immediately.
Totally. So no dry lectures today. The goal here is to make these concepts permanently stick using, you know, kind of absurd examples, a cast of recurring characters, and some direct pop quizzes right at you.
Which is really the best way to do it. Because passing the Series 7, it's not about just memorizing rules. Like, you can't just flashcard your way through this.
Right.
It's about understanding why the rules exist. What's fascinating here is that once you understand the core motivation behind, like, why a company issues a right versus a warrant, the exam questions basically just answer themselves.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. So let's start closest to home. All right. Part one, the dilution solution. Preemptive rights.
The foundation.
Right. Because before a company can look overseas or, you know, issue crazy bonds, they have to protect their original owners.
Hmm.
That's just the law.
Yeah. They have to take care of the people who were there on day one.
So let's bring in our first recurring character. We're going to call him Peter, the pizza parlor owner.
Okay. I like Peter.
Yeah. Peter's great. Let's say Peter owns 10% of this incredibly lucrative, I don't know, 10 slice pizza company. He's got one slice out of the 10.
A very solid slice.
A great slice. But the company wants to expand. They want to bring in some new partners. So they decide to bake up 10 brand new slices.
Right. So now there's 20 slices total.
Exactly. Yeah. And if they just sell those 10 new slices directly to the public, Peter has a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
He still only has his one original slice.
Right.
So his stake in the whole pie just shrank from 10% down to 5%.
He's diluted.
He is totally diluted. His voting power is cut in half. His claim on the profits is cut in half.
Which is exactly why preemptive rights exist. They're the fix for that exact problem.
Right.
Or you might see them called subscription rights on the exam. Same thing.
Rights, subscription rights.
Yeah. Basically, the corporate charter grants Peter the first dibs. He has the right to buy those new slices before the public even gets a chance, so he can maintain his exact proportionate ownership.
Okay. So to keep his 10%, he needs to buy 10% of the 10 new slices. So he gets to buy one new slice.
Exactly. They send him a right in the mail for every share he currently owns, giving him that privilege. But there are mechanics to this that the exam loves to test.
Right.
First, rights are strictly short term. I'm talking 30 to 90 days. The pizza company needs the money now to expand. They can't just wait around for Peter to make up his mind.
Right. It's an immediate call to action.
Yeah. And the second thing, and this is crucial, the subscription price, the price Peter pays for that new slice, is set below the current market price.
Okay, wait, let me pause you there. Because this sounds absurd on paper. Why below market? Like, if Peter's pizza slices are trading for 10 bucks in the open market, why would the company let him buy a brand new one for 8 bucks? Aren't they losing money?
It seems like it, right? But think about it from Peter's perspective. If the market price is $10 and the company says, hey, Peter, you have the special privilege of buying a new slice from us for $10.
Yeah, to just be like, whatever.
Exactly. You'd say, why would I fill out this corporate paperwork? I can just call my broker and buy a slice for $10 right now.
And there's no incentive.
So if it wasn't at a discount, it wouldn't actually be a privilege. It wouldn't force him to open his wallet. By pricing it at $8, that right has inherent immediate value. It's essentially a coupon that puts him $2 in the money the second he receives it.
Right. Okay. That makes perfect sense. It's the bait to get the capital raise done.
Exactly.
Okay. Listener, I want you to pause and think right now. Direct question for you. Let's introduce another character. Distracted Dave.
Oh, Dave.
Yeah. Distracted Dave. Dave is a shareholder and he gets a preemptive right in the mail. Does Dave get to use that right to vote at the next shareholder meeting?
Good question.
I'm going to give you a beat. Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
No, he does not. Rights holders have zero voting rights, and they receive no dividends. You are not a stockholder of those new shares until you actually exercise the right.
Right, until you hand over the cash and take delivery of the stock, You're just holding a coupon. You can't eat a coupon for pizza. You have to redeem it first.
I love that. You can't eat a coupon. Okay, let's talk about the math, because this is where the exam really tries to get you. The theoretical value of a right.
Oh, yeah. This trips up so many people.
It really does. So there are two formulas, right? Cum rights, which means with rights, and ex rights, which means without rights.
Yeah. So when a stock is trading cum rights, the right is still attached to the stock. If I buy the stock today, I get the upcoming right too. And the formula for that is the market price minus the subscription price divided by the number of rights needed to buy one share plus one.
Right, that plus one in the denominator. Okay, I have a trick for this that I want everyone to memorize right now.
Let's hear it.
Okay, cum means with, right, like you said. So think of it like you're buying a combo meal at a fast food place.
Okay.
You're buying a burger that comes with a drink. So because you're getting two things, the stock and the right,
yeah,
you have to add a plus one to the denominator. You add plus one for the drink.
That is actually a really great way to remember it. The plus one accounts for that bundled value.
Right. But then eventually, the right detaches. It goes X rights.
Exactly. X rights means the right is gone. It's trading separately. So if you buy the stock now, you don't get the right.
The drink is gone.
The drink is gone. So the formula changes. It's just market price minus subscription price divided by the number of rights needed, no plus one.
No plus one, because there's no drink, just the burger.
Just the burger. And logically, the reason for this is that on the X rights date, the market price of the stock automatically drops by the value of the right. The market adjusts for the fact that the drink is gone. So you don't need the plus one in the math anymore.
Okay, that is so clear. But let's go back to distracted Dave for a second. Let's say Dave gets his 30-day window to use his rights. But he gets distracted. He loses the mail. He forgets, whatever. His 30 days expire.
Very common.
Right? Retail investors do this all the time. But the pizza company still needs that money to build the new ovens. So what happens if Dave just ignores his rights? Does the company just not get the money?
Well, no. A smart company doesn't leave a multi-million dollar expansion up to whether distracted Dave checks his mail.
Right. That would be a terrible business plan.
Yeah. So before they even announce the rights offering, they hire what's called a standby underwriter.
Okay, a standby underwriter.
It's an investment bank that comes in and says, hey, we will provide a firm commitment. We guarantee that any leftover slices, any shares that the Daves of the world forget to buy, we will sweep them up and buy them ourselves.
So they act like a backstop.
Exactly. For a fee, of course. But they ensure the company walks away with the exact amount of capital they originally asked for, no matter what the retail investors do.
That's awesome. Okay, so that's preemptive rights, a defensive shield for existing owners like Peter. But what if the company wants to bring in new money?
A totally different strategy.
Right. They don't want to just hit up Peter again. They want outside capital. So let's talk about warrants. Part two, the sweetener.
The sweetener. That's the perfect word for it.
Let's bring in our third character, Wendy, the wealthy warrant buyer.
Wendy's got deep pockets.
Wendy is loaded. And this company wants Wendy to buy their corporate bonds. But let's say this company makes something totally absurd, like edible shoes.
Edible shoes?
Yeah, edible shoes. It's a highly unproven business model.
Very risky.
Right. So normally, to get Wendy to lend them money for an edible shoe factory, they'd have to pay a massive interest rate on the bond. Like 15%.
Which would bankrupt an early stage startup. They can't afford 15%.
So they go to Wendy and say, hey, we'll give you a bond, but we're only going to pay you 5%.
And Wendy says, no way.
Right. Wendy's like, I'm not locking up my money for a terrible 5% yield on edible shoes.
So they have to sweeten the deal. They attach a warrant to the bond.
And what exactly is that warrant doing for her?
The warrant gives Wendy the right to buy the company's common stock at a fixed price in the future. It's a little kicker. It says, hey, take the low 5% interest rate now, and if our edible shoes take over the world, you get to buy our stock on the cheap later.
Okay, but let's look at the mechanics, because they are the opposite of rights. First, warrants are long-term.
Very long-term.
We're talking 2 to 5 years minimum, sometimes 10 years. Sometimes they're even perpetual warrants that never expire.
Wow. Okay, so rights are weeks, warrants are years.
Exactly.
And the pricing is backwards, too. With Peter's rights, the price was below market. But Wendy's warrant.
The exercise price is set above the current market price.
It's issued out of the money.
Okay, pushback time. Because if the edible shoe stock is trading at $50 today, and the warrant says Wendy gets the privilege of paying $60 for it?
Yeah.
That sounds like a terrible deal. Why does she want that?
Because of the time value premium, you have to remember, Wendy have 5 years. She doesn't have to exercise it today.
Oh, right.
So she just sits back and collects her 5% interest. But if in year four, edible shoes become a massive TikTok trend and the stock rockets to $100 a shoe, yeah. Now the market price is $100, but Wendy pulls out her warrant and it legally guarantees she can buy those shares for $60.
So she can buy at $60 and instantly sell at $100.
Exactly. She makes a $40 profit per share. That equity upside is why she accepted the low interest rate on the bond in the first place.
Okay, that is huge. Yeah. But wait. Alert.
Oh,
alert. Wow. Stop the track. I'm stopping the track right now. Pattern interrupt.
What's going on?
We need a reality check on dilution. Because we spent the whole first part talking about how preemptive rights prevent dilution for Peter.
Right.
But think about Wendy. When Wendy exercises her warrant in year four, she hands the company her $60 per share. Where do those shares come from?
The company prints them. They issue brand new shares out of thin air to give to Wendy.
Meaning the total number of shares just went up. The pie got bigger.
Yep.
Which means existing owners like Peter just got their slices shrunk.
Mm-hmm.
So warrants cause dilution.
They absolutely cause dilution, which is a huge testable point. Because they cause dilution to the existing owners, a board of directors can't just hand out warrants whenever they want.
They can't.
No. Issuing warrants generally requires stockholder approval. The existing shareholders, like Peter, have to actually vote and agree to take on that future dilution.
Oh, wow. That makes so much sense. Rights are in the charter to protect you, but warrants dilute you, so you have to vote on them.
Exactly. They have to vote yes, usually because they agree that getting cheap financing today is worth getting diluted a little bit tomorrow.
Okay, that is a huge connection for the exam. But what happens to Wendy if the company messes with the stock during those 5 years? Like, let's say the stock goes to 100, but the company does a 2-for-1 stock split, so the price drops back to 50. Does Wendy just lose all her warrant value?
No, the institutional investors protect themselves. Warrants have anti-dilution provisions built into the contract.
So how does that fix the split?
It adjusts everything proportionally. If there's a 2-for-1 split, the warrant's exercise price drops by half, from 60 down to 30, and the number of shares she's allowed to buy doubles.
Oh, so her economic position stays exactly the same.
Right. The math self-corrects, so she doesn't get screwed by corporate actions.
Brilliant. Okay, part three, the ultimate showdown. Rights versus warrants side by side. The exam loves to mash these two up to confuse people.
They really do. They'll throw features of both into one question.
So let's do a rapid-fire ping-pong match. Peter the pizza owner versus Wendy the wealthy investor. I'll give the category, you give the breakdown. Duration.
Rights are short-term, 30 to 90 days. Warrants are long-term, 2 to 5 years or more.
Price.
Rights are issued below the current market price. Warrants are issued above the current market price.
Purpose.
Rights allow existing owners to maintain their proportionate ownership. Warrants act as a sweetener to make a debt offering more attractive to new investors.
Authority to issue.
Rights are usually built into the corporate charter. Warrants require stockholder approval because they cause dilution.
Bam. Okay, pop quiz time for the listener. Pause and think. Distracted Dave buys a bond, and it comes with a certificate that lets him buy common stock in 3 years at a price that is higher than today's market. Is this a right or a warrant?
Give him a second.
It's a warrant. It's long-term and above market price. You got to nail those distinctions. But what do they have in common? Because that's where the exam really tries to get you.
Right. The commonalities are tricky. The big one is that neither a right nor a warrant makes you an actual stockholder.
Oh, right. Because they're just coupons.
Exactly. Until you exercise them, you get no dividends and you have absolutely no voting rights.
Right.
Another commonality is that they are both tradable on the secondary market. They have independent value. If Wendy gets bored in year two, she can detach her warrant and sell it to someone else.
Then they both result in new shares being issued, right?
Yes. That is a critical point. If you buy a stock on the New York Stock Exchange today, you're buying it from another investor on the secondary market. No new shares are created. But if you exercise a right or a warrant, that is a primary market transaction.
You're handing cash directly to the company.
Exactly. And the company creates brand new shares to give to you. So both instruments increase the total number of outstanding shares.
That is such a good distinction. Okay, so that is the domestic side of equity extensions. But let's look across the ocean. Part four, foreign ordinary shares and the ADR solution.
This is where things get really interesting.
Yeah, so Wendy made an absolute fortune on those edible shoe warrants.
Good for her.
Good for Wendy. And now she wants to diversify. She wants to invest in a massive tech startup based in, let's say, Europe, run by our fourth character, Fiona the foreign founder.
Okay, Fiona.
Fiona has a great company, so why can't Wendy just log into her E-Trade or Charles Schwab account and just buy Fiona's foreign ordinary shares directly?
I mean, theoretically she could try, but it is a massive headache. The friction is just unbelievable for a U.S. investor.
Friction like what?
Well, first, Wendy needs a specialized foreign broker to even access the European exchange. Her normal retail app probably won't do it.
Okay, that's annoying.
Then you have time zones. If Fiona's stock is trading in Europe or especially Asia, the market is open while Wendy is fast asleep. If there's breaking news, she can't react in real time unless she stays up until 3 a.m.
Yeah, no thanks. I value my sleep way too much for that.
Right. And you also have regulatory friction. Different countries have different settlement cycles. In the U.S., it's T+1. Over there, who knows? The legal protections are totally different. But the biggest nightmare is the currency conversion.
Oh, right, because Fiona's stock trades in euros or yen or whatever.
Exactly. Wendy has U.S. dollars, so she has to manually convert her dollars into the foreign currency, pay a conversion fee, execute the trade, and then when she wants to sell, she has to convert it all back, paying another fee. The spreads will just eat her alive.
So it's just too much work. Wendy's not going to do it. Most Americans won't do it. But Fiona wants American money, right?
Oh, she desperately wants access to the U.S. capital markets. It's the deepest pool of money in the world.
So how do they bridge the gap?
They use an American depository receipt, an ADR.
Okay, explain the magic of the ADR. How does it fix all this friction?
It is honestly a brilliant piece of financial engineering. So a massive U.S. depository bank, someone like a J.P. Morgan or a BNY Mellon, they step in and say, we will handle the edict.
Oh, okay.
The U.S. bank goes overseas and they buy a massive chunk of Fiona's shares on her local exchange. Millions of shares.
So the bank acts as the giant wholesale buyer.
Exactly. Then the U.S. bank takes those foreign shares and puts them in a highly secure vault at a custodian bank over in Fiona's home country. They just lock them up.
Okay.
Then the U.S. bank comes back to New York and issues U.S. dollar denominated certificates receipts against those vaulted shares. And those receipts are the ADRs.
So Wendy just buys the receipt.
Right. And suddenly all her problems are solved. She buys the ADR in U.S. dollars through her regular U.S. broker during normal U.S. market hours, and it settles on the regular U.S. T+1 cycle.
It feels exactly like buying an American stock.
Exactly. It's totally seamless. Yeah. And the bank even sets the ratio. So maybe one ADR equals one foreign share. Or maybe if Fiona stock trades at like $200, the bank will say, okay, one ADR represents half a share, so they can price the ADR at an attractive $100 for retail investors.
The ADR ratio. That makes a lot of sense. So pattern interrupt time. So this is the biggest exam trap in this entire section.
Huge trap.
Okay, so Wendy is buying these ADRs in U.S. dollars. She's trading on a U.S. exchange in dollars. When she checks her portfolio, it says she has, you know, $10,000 worth of Fiona's company. So she doesn't have to worry about Fiona's crazy local currency fluctuating anymore, right?
It's stop P right there.
Right.
This is exactly what the exam wants you to think, and it is completely wrong. ADRs do not eliminate currency risk.
Say again for the people on the back.
ADRs do not eliminate currency risk. I cannot stress this enough.
Okay, but how? If it's priced in dollars, how is she losing money on currency?
Because the ADR is just a piece of paper that represents the shares sitting in the vault in Europe. And those shares in the vault are still priced in Fiona's local currency. The U.S. dollar price you see on your screen is just a real-time mathematical translation of that foreign value.
Okay, wait, I love the translation analogy. Like, imagine you have a book.
Yeah.
And it's written in, you know, French.
Yeah.
And it's a terrible, boring book.
The worst book ever.
Right. And then you say, well, I want to sell this in America. So you translate it perfectly into English. You print it in English, you sell it in U.S. dollars at Barnes & Noble, that's the ADR. It's super convenient for an American to read.
Very easy to read.
But translating it didn't change the plot. If the original story in French is terrible, the English version is still going to be a terrible story.
That is exactly it. The wrapper is convenient, but the underlying asset hasn't fundamentally changed.
Okay, let's put numbers on it because that helps me.
Yeah.
Let's say Fiona stock trades in Europe at exactly 100 euros.
Okay.
And right now, the euro and the dollar are trading 1-to-1. Perfect parity. So the U.S. bank prices Wendy's ADR at 100 U.S. dollars.
Makes sense.
So Wendy owns one ADR worth 100 bucks.
Yep.
Over the next month, Fiona's company does great. The stock price in Europe doesn't move a single penny, it is completely flat at 100 euros.
Solid.
BET. The euro completely tanks on the global currency markets. The euro gets super weak against the dollar. Now, it takes 2 euros to equal $1.
The currency just got cut in half.
Right. So what happens to Wendy's ADR price in New York?
The bank has to recalculate the translation. The shares in the vault are still worth 100 euros. But since it now takes 2 euros to make a dollar, they divide by two. The ADR price instantly drops to 50 US dollars.
Wow.
Wendy just lost 50% of her investment, even though Fiona's actual stock price didn't drop a single penny. That is the currency risk of an ADR.
That is wild. It's like a phantom loss. Okay, direct listener question right here. Pop quiz. Which of the following eliminates currency risk for a U.S. investor? A, foreign ordinary shares. B, ADRs. C, both. Or D, neither. Take a second.
It's a trick.
It is a trick. The answer is D, neither. Neither of them eliminates currency risk. ADRs add convenience, not a risk-free wrapper.
You have to know that for the test. It's guaranteed to be on there.
Okay, so that leads us perfectly into part five. ADR dividends, taxes, and the three levels. Because we have to follow the money.
Always follow the money.
Let's say Fiona's company declares a massive cash dividend. How does Wendy actually get paid?
So Fiona's company pays the dividend in euros into that custodian bank vault.
Okay.
The U.S. Depository Bank takes those euros, converts them into U.S. dollars at whatever the current exchange rate happens to be, taking a little conversion fee for themselves, of course.
Naturally.
Naturally. And then they deposit those U.S. dollars directly into Wendy's brokerage account. So again, she bears the currency risk on the dividend payout, too.
Right. Because if the euro is weak that day, she gets fewer dollars.
Exactly. But there's another trap here. The exam will ask about taxation. When Fiona's company pays that dividend out, Fiona's home country, the foreign government, is probably going to step in and withhold a percentage of it for foreign taxes.
Before it even gets converted to dollars.
Right. So Wendy gets a smaller amount. The exam tries to get you to think, oh no, Wendy is getting double taxed. Because the IRS is going to tax her on the U.S. dollar she receives, plus the foreign government took a cut. Is that withheld money just gone forever?
Yeah, that seems really unfair to the investor.
The IRS agrees. So they created a mechanism. The money that the foreign government withheld can generally qualify for a U.S. foreign tax credit.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, Wendy can claim that withheld amount on her U.S. tax return to directly offset the U.S. taxes she owes on that dividend. It's specifically designed to prevent double taxation.
That is a great rule to remember. Claim the foreign tax credit.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's talk about how these ADRs actually get created in the first place. Because they aren't all the same. We need to distinguish between sponsored and unsponsored ADRs.
Right. This all comes down to how involved Fiona is in the process.
Right.
If Fiona, as the CEO, actively wants to court American investors, she will formally partner with a U.S. depository bank. Her company pays the fees, they sign agreements, they help set it up. That is a sponsored ADR.
So she's officially sponsoring the U.S. listing.
Exactly. And because the company is officially involved, the voting rights are usually passed straight through to the American investors. Wendy gets to vote just like she owned the normal shares.
Got it. But what if Fiona doesn't care about America? What if some U.S. bank just looks at her company and goes, wow, Americans would love to trade this. I'm going to make an ADR myself to collect the conversion fees. Can they just do that without her permission?
They absolutely can. And that creates an unsponsored ADR. The bank just buys the shares on the open market and issues the receipts. Fiona has nothing to do with it.
So it's unsponsored.
Right. And because Fiona isn't cooperating, the voting rights usually stay with the depository bank. Wendy doesn't get to vote. And more importantly, unsponsored ADRs have virtually no SEC reporting requirements. Because of that, they are strictly limited to trading on the over-the-counter market, the OTC. They cannot list on the big exchanges.
Okay, so sponsored ADRs are the real deal, and unsponsored are basically just OTC knockoffs.
Basically, yeah.
Now, within the sponsored ADRs, the ones where Fiona is actually cooperating, there are three distinct levels. And these levels dictate exactly what Fiona is allowed to do in the U.S. markets. I love using the swimming pool analogy for this.
It's the best way to visualize the regulatory burden.
Right. So let's start with level one.
Level one is just dipping your toe in the pool.
Just a toe.
Fiona wants a U.S. presence, but she doesn't want to deal with the SEC. She doesn't want to pay millions of dollars for U.S. accounting audits. She just wants it to be easy.
So what are the restrictions if she's only dipping a toe?
Because the SEC reporting is so minimal, they basically just file a simple form. F6 level 1 ADRs are also restricted to trading over the counter. Just like the unsponsored ones. They can't go on the NYSE or NASDAQ.
Okay, so level one is OTC, dipping a toe. What's level two?
Level two is wading into the pool. You're up to your waist. You are committed now.
Okay, so what does wading in get you?
Level two gets you listed on the premier U.S. exchanges, the NYSE or the NASDAQ. But to get that privilege, Fiona has to agree to much stricter SEC oversight. She has to file comprehensive annual reports, specifically Form 20-F.
Form 20-F. Okay, but wait, if she's filing SEC reports, doesn't she have to translate all her European accounting into American accounting, like U.S. GAAP?
Historically, yes, and it was a nightmare. But there is a huge exception now, and the exam loves to test it. If Fiona's company uses IFRS International Financial Reporting Standards, specifically as issued by the IASB, the SEC accepts it as is.
Really?
Yeah. No costly reconciliation to U.S. GAAP is required if they use the official IASB IFRS.
Wow. Okay, that's a great detail. So level one is OTC, level two is NYSE with Form 20-F. Now, what about level three?
Level three is climbing up to the high dive and jumping into the deepest end of the pool.
The deep end.
The deep end. Level three is the only level of ADR that allows a foreign company to raise brand new capital in the United States.
Let me underline that. That is massive.
It's the biggest distinction. With level one and level two, American investors are just trading existing shares back and forth on the secondary market. No new money goes to Fiona. But a level three ADR is a primary public offering. Fiona is selling brand new shares directly to Americans to raise fresh cash.
And because she's taking new American money, the SEC brings the hammer down.
Exactly. Full, total SEC registration. They have to file the 20-F, plus they have to file a prospectus, which for foreign companies is Form F-1, to officially register the new securities. It's the maximum regulatory scrutiny.
All right. Direct listener question. Distracted Dave wants to buy an ADR that just did an IPO in the U.S. to raise $50 million to build a new factory. What level is this ADR?
Yeah.
Level three. Because of the word raise. Only level three can raise new capital. If you see raise, you think level three. Period.
Period.
All right. We have covered so much ground today. From the internal mechanics of a pizza parlor all the way to global currency translation. Let's lock this in for exam day.
Let's do it.
Time for the rapid fire recap. I'll tee up the concept. You knock down the core testable takeaways.
I'm ready.
Let's go. Preemptive rights.
Short term, 30 to 90 days. The subscription price is set below market to give it intrinsic value.
Yeah.
And they exist to allow existing owners to maintain their proportionate ownership. They prevent dilution.
Cum rights versus X rights calculation.
Cum rights means the right is attached. So you add a plus one to the denominator.
Yeah.
Think of it like a combo meal with a drink. X rights means the right has detached, the stock price drops, and there's no plus one in the formula.
Long term, 2 to 5 years, sometimes a perpetual. The exercise price is set above market. They act as a sweetener for bonds. And because exercising them prints new shares, they cause dilution, which means they require stockholder approval.
The ultimate similarities between rights and warrants.
Neither one gives you voting power. Neither one pays dividends until you actually exercise them. Both trade on the secondary market. And exercising either one is a primary market transaction that creates new shares.
ADRs versus foreign ordinary shares.
ADRs are issued by U.S. depository banks. They give Americans convenience, U.S. dollars, U.S. exchanges, U.S. hours. But they absolutely do not eliminate currency risk. The foreign currency fluctuation will directly impact your ADR value, even if the foreign stock price doesn't move.
ADR, dividends and taxes.
Dividends are converted to dollars, so there's currency risk there too. And if a foreign government withholds taxes, you can claim a U.S. foreign tax credit to avoid double taxation.
And finally, the sponsored ADR levels.
Level one is OTC with minimal reporting. Level two is listed on major U.S. exchanges and files Form 20-F. And they can use IFRS without GAAP reconciliation. Level three is full SEC registration because it is the only level allowed to raise brand new capital from U.S. investors.
Boom. Unbelievable recap. If you got all that, you are going to destroy the equity extension section of the Series 7.
You know, if I can just leave everyone with one final thought.
Go for it.
If you connect all this to the bigger picture, all of these instruments, rights, warrants, ADRs, they're really just bridges.
Bridges. I like that.
Yeah, they're bridges across time. Like a warrant bridges a startup's risky present to its profitable future, or they're bridges across oceans, like an ADR connecting a European founder to the massive liquidity of the U.S. market. When you're studying this, the mechanics and the formulas can feel really tedious. But this is the actual plumbing of the global financial system. This is how the multi-trillion dollar tech giants of today control their cap tables, incentivize early investors, and tap into global capital to build the future.
Bridges across time and oceans.
the literal plumbing of the global economy. I love that. When you sit down for that exam, don't just stare at the words. Remember Peter defending his pizza slice. Remember Wendy demanding her upside. And remember Fiona crossing the ocean. And whatever you do, do not forget that ADRs carry currency risk. Go ace that exam. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.